The scripture reading is Psalms 139, 19 through 24, which will be up on the wall. You can look in your Bible if you want. I will read to you these six verses. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am I not grieved with those who rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. You may be seated. You will notice these verses tell us who will slay the wicked. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. And David hates those who hate his God. Do we hate those who hate our God? It's not what the conventional Christianity says. You love everybody. And then who are those people who hate his God? Are they in existence today? I was born in 1942. My mother, in 1913, she would have turned 100 years old this year. The Federal Reserve System went into effect in the last days of the year in which she came into this world. What a sinful disaster that has been. But there was something else that happened the year that she was born. And I want to tell you about it today. All through the time that my mother was alive, I remember a long song that she would break out and sing. The lyrics of the song seemed difficult to understand the real meaning, and she didn't know all of the song, only about a fourth of the song. Well, we, that's myself, my brother and sister, would ask her, "Mother, what does that song mean?" She would always just laugh and say that she really didn't know. It was about a little girl who was murdered in a pencil factory. Murdered in a pencil factory, I would answer. What does that have to do with anything? As the years rolled on, I gradually learned a little bit more. So this past Tuesday, November 3rd, 2009, I was excited when I saw that there was a movie about what my mother used to sing. I read the explanation of what the main points of the movie that was going to broadcast on Monday. Monday, I thought. Today is Tuesday. I missed it. It was being televised on cable. But that was the break that I needed. I Googled and dogpiled the topic, and was shocked at what I learned. It took almost 67 years, but I finally learned what the song was about, and that it played a major part in American history. Situations and events that I had taken part in and visited over my lifetime began to be put together into the right view of what really happened. I worked the rest of the week on the message and was excited to bring it to you on Sunday. Now it's 4 years later. I was rummaging through my past sermons and found this one that I gave. Now I was going to bring it. I wrote it all up 2 weeks ago. But I got so disturbed by what was going on. By Martin Luther Jr.'s 50 years, I took the time to write that sermon. And then I was going to bring another sermon. I said, I'm going to bring this one. Because my last sermon, I talked about what happened in America 50 years ago, the Martin Luther King debacle. So it seemed fitting that today I'd speak about what happened in America 100 years ago. So I worked on this sermon. I've got other stuff than I brought in 2009. I've added other things. But it's a fabulous story. If you weren't here in 2009 and didn't hear it, which I think a lot of you did probably never heard this sermon, I think you will enjoy it. Our mother was a singer. She sang with her sisters all over northern Kentucky in church after church. They also sang on WLW 700 AM radio. Music just flowed out of her as she did her daily chores. But there was one song that Mother didn't know what it meant. She only knew about a fourth of the verses of this long song. Now, I'm going to give you all the verses, and there's some variations of the song, but this, it is recorded. The song goes, Little Mary Fagan went to town one day and went to the pencil factory to see the big parade. She left home at 11 and kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Leo Frank met her with the brutal heart we know. He smiled and said, Little Mary, now you will go home no more. He sneaked along behind her till she reached the metal room. He laughed and said, Little Mary, you have met your fatal doom. She fell upon her knees, and to Leo Frank she pled. He took the stick from the trash pile and hit her across the head. The tears rolled down her rosy cheeks while the blood flowed down her back, but she still remembered telling her mother what time she would be back. He killed Little Mary Fagan. It was on a holiday, and he called on Jim Conley to take her body away. He took her to the basement. She was bound hand and feet, and down in the basement, Little Mary lay asleep. Newt Lee was the watchman. He went to wind his key. Away down in the basement was nothing he could see. They phoned for the officers, their names I do not know. They came to the pencil factory, says the newt, you must go. They took him to the jailhouse. They bound him in his cell. The poor old innocent Negro had nothing he could tell. Mother seats a-weeping, she weeps and mourns all day and hopes to meet her darling in a better land someday. Come, all you good people, wherever you may be. Suppose that little Mary belonged to you or me. I have no idea in my mind when Frankie comes to die and stands for an examination in the courthouse in the sky. He'll be so astonished to what the angels say and how he killed little Mary upon that holiday. Judge Roan passed a sentence. He passes it very well. The Christian doors of heaven sent Leo Frank to hell. I guess now you know why my mother didn't know all the verses. What a strange song. Did you notice the last two lines? The Christian doors of heaven sent Leo Frank to hell. How did they do that? Who were the Christian doors of heaven? And why and how did they send Leo Frank to hell? Well, 67 years, I finally learned the meaning of this song. Before I give the explanation to you, I want to look at a couple of verses. So John chapter 7, verse 1, It says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. Now, Galilee was where? Up in the northern part. For he would not walk in Judea. Where was Judea? In the southern part. Because somebody wanted to kill him. Now, these were the verses that really got me into Christian identity. I read these verses, and there's verse after verse after verse where it's the same people. Now, notice this verse doesn't say that the Muslims wanted to kill Jesus. It doesn't say the Hindus wanted to kill Jesus. It doesn't say the Buddhists wanted to kill Jesus. It says the Jews. Jesus would not go to Judea, which is the southern part, because the Jews sought to kill him. He stayed up in the northern part. Now we'll look at John chapter 7, verse 13. Later at the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, we're about ready to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, aren't we? So it's about this time of the year. It said that, howbeit no man spoke openly of him, that referring to Jesus, for fear of the Jews. Here it says that no man spoke openly of him because they feared the Jews. They didn't fear the people of any other religion, but they feared the Jews. I don't know why it's so hard for the modern day Christian to understand. Then in the next chapter, that's John chapter 8, we find Jesus had a strong confrontation with these same people. Jesus said to the Jews of his day, but now you seek to kill me. He knew who wanted to kill him. You're seeking to kill me. A man that has told you the truth. Jesus told them the truth, and they wanted to kill him. You do the deeds of your father. Jesus said to them, if God were your father, that kind of destroys the Freemasonic fatherhood of all men. Fatherhood of God, yes. Everyone's the children of God. No. If God were your father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and come from God. Why do you not understand my speech? Even because ye, now he's talking to the Jews, cannot hear my word. The Jews cannot hear the word of God. You are of the father, the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. So he's caught a bunch of liars. They can't do the truth. They're liars. Doesn't this teach, along with many, many, many other verses, that these people cannot be the hearers of the truth? They have a different father. They are antichrists. They are vipers and not sheep. And there's no way you can change a viper into a sheep. Now I will give you the story of Mary Fagan. Mary was a 12-year-old. She looked like she was 18. That looks like an 18-year-old, but she was only 12 years old. She was born in Marietta, Georgia, and had moved recently to Atlanta. Her father had passed away, and her mom had remarried. The stepfather had a different job, but this was 1913, 100 years ago. Times were different. Now, there's the picture of Mary Fagan when she was 12 years old. There were no televisions. No computers, no calculators, no iPods, no cell phones, no videos, on it goes. There were telephones, but they were line phones, and there was a switchboard operator. Public schools were different. Mary was informed by her school that she couldn't go until next semester when they would have enough seats. So Mary went to work at the pencil factory. This was actually the fourth factory she worked at. She's 12 years old in her fourth factory. At the pencil factory, her boss was Leo Franck. He was born in Texas and moved to Brooklyn for his school years. He graduated from Cornell University. He married a girl who was descended from a strong, what kind of family? Jewish family that had been instrumental in building the first synagogue in Atlanta, Georgia. It was there that they eventually moved when Leo accepted a job supervising the pencil factory. It was owned by her uncle. This is a bad line here, who had served in the Confederate Army. This is a picture up there of the National Pencil Company. Leo Franck was Jewish, and he was a perverted bisexual. He was a socialite. He was like Jekyll and Hyde. And he was something else. He was president of the Atlanta B'nai B'rith. What's the B'nai B'rith? Well, it's basically the Jewish Lodge of the Freemasons. And he was also a frequent guest at the local, how do I say this, whorehouse. It was not uncommon for him to take advantage of both boys and girls in his pencil factory office. All this came out in the court case. It was said that he would station Jim Conley, who was a Negro, outside his door and signal him to lock and unlock the door whenever he would get a boy or girl inside his office to molest. This was the situation when on April 26, 1913, Mary came to the pencil factory office to get her paycheck. Mary had worked only one day that week. She worked on Monday. She was off the rest of the week because the metal that she put onto the pencil was not in stock. Later in the week, this was 1913 now, it was told the workers that they would be paid on Friday and not Saturday because Saturday was a holiday. Does anybody know what the holiday was? Confederate Memorial Holidays. The pencil factory and most of the stores were closed. Mary took the trolley from her home to the pencil factory. It took about 10 minutes. She told her friends that after she got her check, she would join them for the parade. At noon, Mary went up to the second floor office of Mr. Franck to get her check. Her pay for one day's work was how much? $1.20. My, how inflation has changed our lives. Well, her check was given to her by Mr. Franck. This much was held to be true by both sides in the courtroom. But after this, there were some major differences. The case went to court from July 28th. July 28th was the day our mother was buried, and it's my sister's birthday, till August 14th, 1913. So the case lasted 2.5 weeks. And do you know it became a major national story? Newspapers were well represented, and they ran stories from both sides. There were two major detective agencies involved. It became the case of the century. You had North versus South, Jew versus Christian, black versus Jew, country versus city, wealth versus low income, boss versus worker, on and on. There were multitudes in the country that were caught up in the interest and the outcome of these two cases. Remember, you could not get the results instantly like it happens today. The testimony informs us, after Mr. Frank gave Mary her check, she asked if the medals had arrived. Remember, that's why she hadn't worked the last 4 days. The medals weren't there. Mr. Frank told Mary that he did not know for sure. They would have to go to the back of the building and see if the medal had arrived. So they both went to the back room at the end of the building. There, Mr. Frank, in a cocaine-induced rage, made his advancements on Mary. She was a virgin and resisted his moves. Mr. Frank slapped her real hard, and she lost consciousness. Shortly thereafter, Mary woke up, and Mr. Frank grabbed a stick and hit her. Her underwear was pulled way up and torn and placed around her neck. Eventually, the cord that was used in the pencil business was also tied tightly around her neck. Suddenly, she was dead. Mr. Frank called for Mr. Conley, and he helped take her deceased body two floors down to the basement. They planned to burn her in the furnace. But then they remembered that it was a holiday, and people would recognize something was wrong if the furnace was on. So after dragging Mary to the basement, she was so full of cinders and ashes that the police, when they first found her, thought she was a black girl. And that's where they left her, hoping that no one would discover her until they could burn her in the furnace the next day. But like always happens, God says God will unveil your sin. But the night watchman went to the bathroom in the basement, and he happened to see the body near the furnace. He called the police at 3 o'clock in the morning. The police arrived and ruined the drag marks in the crime scene, including the fingerprints. The police called Mr. Frank at 4 o'clock in the morning, but there was no answer. But he was not their first suspect. It was a few days later when the police action turned to him. It seemed that he was so nervous when they talked to him, and he gave detailed answers to small questions that the police naturally suspected him. It was a long case, 2.5 weeks. I'll give you a few of the major developments in the case. The first development: Mr. Frank said he was all day in his office. Another female worker testified that she came 5 minutes after Mary arrived. Mary got there at 12, so she said she got there at 12:05. And Mr. Frank was not in his office. She waited for about 5 minutes and then left. I will talk more about this at the end of this list. The second development: Mr. Frank told his brother-in-law that he would go to the baseball game with him on Saturday afternoon. He failed to go. He canceled his appointment. Mr. Frank got a lawyer to represent him before he was arrested. And an anonymous Jew put up $100,000. This is back in 1913. $100,000 for his defense money. Fourth thing, the testimony of Jen Conley, a sweeper at the factory, was devastating to Leo Frank. In fact, his testimony was so lurid that Judge Roan ordered all women and children cleared from the courtroom. Conley testified he had watched out for Frank on several occasions while he entertained young women in his office. Conley testified that Frank had confessed the murder to him and tried to get him, that's Conley, to burn the body in the factory's basement furnace. But it was a holiday, and he was unwilling to do it. Frank's lawyers were unable to shake Connally's story. They questioned him for about 4 hours. He stuck to his story. The fifth reason. Many of the girls testified that Mr. Frank went into their dressing room unannounced. Some of the girls were completely undressed when he entered the room. The sixth reason. The foreman of Mary's work area testified that she saw Leo on the day of the murder, and he appeared to be on drugs. The seventh is a very interesting case. It says Robert House, an ex-policeman, had said he once caught Leo Frank and a young girl in the woods at Druid Hills Park engaging in immoral acts. According to House, Frank had pleaded with him not to report the incident. The eighth thing. The defense then argued that Frank was the latest in a long line of Jews who were being persecuted for their religious beliefs. And again asserted that Jim Connally was the true murderer. Sounds familiar. Connally and many other prosecution witnesses had shady characters. While Leo Frank had been a pillar of the community, who had many well-respected people, plus many of his employees, testifying on his behalf. If the case came down to Leo Frank's word against Jim Connally's, then it was obvious who should be believed. Now, the next sentence I've never heard before. Frank's attorneys argued that the South blamed who for the Civil War? They blamed the Jews for the Civil War. And I'm coming to that opinion myself. And the buying up of land and businesses that followed. Mr. Frank's cook testified that she heard Leo's wife tell her mother about unusual conduct on the night of the murder. She said that his wife said that Mr. Frank told her to sleep on the rug as he slept on the couch and for her to bring his pistol to him. Afterwards, the cook testified that she received a raise in pay to keep her silent. The tenth thing, Mr. Frank called the whorehouse the day of the murder and asked if she could help in getting rid of Mary's murdered body. Nina Formby, the person Leo called, eventually went to New York, and then she recanted her story. Another witness who was bribed. The 11th reason. There were two notes were written supposedly by Mary Fagan and left near her body, which accused the Negro night watchman of the murder. But Jim Connally testified that he wrote the notes, and they were dictated to him by Mr. Frank. The 12th reason. The grand jury, which had 5 Jews out of the 12 people, only took 10 minutes to hand down a murder indictment against Leo Frank. And there's a picture of the grand jury. The 13th, Adolf Lewison, Samuel Untermeyer. That might ring a bell, Samuel Untermeyer. Lewis Marshall. Oh, I know Rabbi Wise does because he founded the thing in Cincinnati. And other leading Jewish bigwigs beg for clemency. I will tell you that Samuel Untermeyer was a Jewish lawyer who later blackmailed President Wilson and eventually got the United States in World War I and got the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis. He got his revenge. And on it went. There was the bloody shirt the night watchman was found washing. Mr. Frank had committed oral sex many times previous to the murder. By the way, the penalty in Georgia for this crime was death back in 1913. Mr. Connally was the murderer, according to Mr. Frank, and on it goes. I mentioned that I would talk about the fact that Mr. Frank was in his office all day. Something very interesting happened 1 week after the murder of Mary Fagan. The event was an unexpected major breakthrough that occurred when detectives stumbled upon one of the child labor employees who had formerly worked at the National Pencil Company. Inside the business office that formerly belonged to Leo Frank, there was a young 14-year-old girl whose name was Motine Stover, with her incensed stepmother. She was there to make what astonishing turned out to be a second attempt at collecting her pay envelope because she had failed the first time on the Confederate Memorial Day when she came alone to the factory at 5 minutes past noon. Now, remember, Leo Frank said Mary came at 12 and was there 12:15. When Atlanta police thoroughly questioned Motine Stover, she revealed something rather curious. Stover said that when she arrived at the National Pencil Company exactly 1 week ago and made her first attempt to get her wages, Leo Frank was not in his office like he normally was in the past at the normal payoff time at noon. More chronically specific, Stover said Leo Frank's office was empty when she waited inside it from 12:05 to 12:10, based on the clock in his office. This was earth-shattering news to investigators, because on Monday, April 28, Leo Frank, in the presence of elite attorneys, made a sworn deposition to a room full of Atlanta police detectives that was stenographed, where Frank precisely stated he was in his office alone with Mary Fagan between 12:05 and 12:10. Even more significant is that Leo Frank told the police on Sunday, April 27th, not only that Mary Fagan had come to his office at 12:03 and that he had not left his office until 12:45 p.m. Without Leo Frank knowing the police had discovered and questioned 14-year-old Motine Stover, two detectives approached Leo Frank in his jail cell and asked him again to confirm if he had been in his office every minute on Saturday, April 26th, from noon to 12:45. Leo Frank responded, yes. The officers then took a different angle and asked Leo Frank if he had been in his office every minute Sunday, April 26th, from noon to 12:30. Leo Frank responded again, yes. Then it was that 8 days after the murder of Mary Fagan, the police had discovered a possible discrepancy in Leo Frank's murder alibi. Leo Frank would maintain stoically up until his trial that he had never left his office from noon until he went upstairs to the fourth floor at 12:45 p.m. to tell two employees he was getting ready to leave the building for dinner. As far as the police were concerned, the murder alibi of Leo Frank had possibly been unintentionally shattered by 14-year-old Motine Stover. But they would have to wait 3.5 months to find how Leo Frank would account for his new murder alibi dispute, because that's how long Leo Frank would maintain that he never left his office. But then something electrifying happened. His murder trial. Leo Frank would directly respond to contradiction to his murder alibi caused by Motine Stover's trial testimony about specifically why his office had been empty at the exact time he claimed Fagan was with him alone in his office. Leo Frank changed his original murder alibi that he maintained for over 3 months to explain the real reason why his office was empty between 12:05 and 12:10. It gave away the solution to who killed Mary Fagan. The jury did not take very long. Mr. Frank was found guilty and was sentenced to death. He was sent to jail for men prisoners at Midgeville, Georgia. But he was not roomed with the other inmates. His room was right next to the warden's office. While there, he was viciously attacked by a fellow inmate. His throat was slashed, and he would have died if it wasn't for emergency help. They put pressure on the wound and preserved his life. On the last day of the term of Georgia's governor, he commuted Leo Frank's sentence from death to life. There were complaints of backroom deals with Jews, and the populace was very upset by this move. all the courts that were appealed rejected to hear Mr. Frank's case. Now Mr. Frank was not to be killed, but he'd spend the rest of his days in jail. I'll talk more about that later. Here's where the story gets very, very interesting. For two major organizations began from the murder or execution that was about to happen. Now, the mansion of the governor, after he commuted this sentence from death to life, was attacked. Kind of reminds me of Benghazi. But armed forces saved the governor from harm. But 25 of the elite members of the town of, Marietta, Georgia, a former governor of Georgia, ex-governor, a son of a senator, judges, attorneys, major manufacturers, and other prosperous members of the community came together and planned a miraculous kidnapping. They planned to kidnap Leo Frank from jail. 25 of the most elite men of Marietta, Georgia, drove their cars to the prison, cut the telephone lines, and walked into jail to Leo Frank's room and kidnapped him. Not a shot was fired. It was an inside job. They had help. They put Mr. Frank in one of the cars and drove off to Marietta on the back roads, which was about a 200-mile journey. The trip lasted most of the night. They got to Marietta and found the large oak tree that was across the house where Mary was born. Around the limb, they tossed the rope, had Mr. Frank climb upon a table, put the lasso around his neck, and then kicked the table away. Mr. Frank's neck did not break, so he twisted and turned as he suffocated to death. This was the only lynching of a Jew in America had just occurred. No one who was involved in this lynching was ever punished or ever identified. When the news spread that there was a dead body hanging from the oak tree at Marietta, thousands descended upon the scene. Now I got the Atlanta Constitution headline. Mob takes Frank from jail. Well, there are two major organizations. The first one, shortly thereafter, a group met at Stone Mountain, Georgia. Many who were there in the kidnapping and lynching of Mr. Frank were there in Stone Mountain. They read Bible verses, and they burned a cross, thus giving rebirth to the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan grew to include representatives and senators, governors and judges. In fact, it was the Klan that kept particularly the South in its apartheid situation. The second group, a total of one half of the 3,000 Jews in the entire state of Georgia, fled to other parts of the country. As has happened so many times previously, the Jew has been hated for his lying and for his hatred of who? The descendants of Jacob. With the trial of Leo Frank, the president of the local B'nai B'rith, the issue of the Jew was once again being brought out. It was the time for the birthing of a new organization to help to fight save the Jew. So what other organization came to birth because of this fabulous murder story? Murder, sentenced to life, kidnapped from jail and hung on a tree across from the house of Mary Fagan. It was the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, came to be born. Now, here's from the ADL's own official website. I got it off their website. Quote, "This was the cry of the furious mob outside the Atlanta courthouse where Leo Frank, a northern Jew, stood trial after his arrest in 1913 for a murder he did not commit. Even if he didn't commit it, he was guilty of so many other things that demanded a death penalty that it was good that he could get killed. Anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism hung heavy in the courtroom as Frank was found guilty and sentenced to death. Then a courageous governor later commuted the death sentence to life imprisonment on the last day of his office. Frank never did serve the term. In August 1915, the Yankee Jew was lynched by a mob calling themselves a vigilance committee. The brutal murder of Leo Frank did not occur in a vacuum. As the 20th century dawned, anti-Semitism was rampant in American society, where resorts commonly advertised, "No dogs, no Jews." Interesting to use the word dog. They must know something about the Bible. And magazines featured humorous characters of Jewish people. It was in this atmosphere that the Anti-Defamation League was established. What year? 1913, by a lawyer and fearless visionary by the name of Sigmund Livingston. Starting with only two desks in Livingston's Chicago office. See, Chicago, that's where who comes from? Obama. Chicago is a big area where a lot of things are done in this country. And it's Chicago's office, $200, and the sponsorship of the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith, a Jewish branch of the Freemasons. Livingston spelled out the league's ambitious, compelling mission: to stop by appeals to reason and conscience, and if necessary, by appeals to law, the defamation of the Jewish people, to secure justice and fair treatment to all citizens alike. Put an end forever to unjust and airfare discrimination against and ridicule of any sect or body of citizens. They don't believe that. They're against us. I've got an article from the B'nai B'rith News. I don't know if you can read it up here. I'll read it to you. KKK, ADL, Leo Frank, and Memorial Day. The Times of Israel posted an interesting article today pondering the historical connection between the Ku Klux Klan, Memorial Day, the Leo Frank lynching, and the founding of the Anti-Defamation League 100 years ago. Also was mentioned Birmingham segregationist Bull Connor. Quote, "Few Americans know that Memorial Day evolved from the vanquished Southern states' own Confederate Memorial Day, launched in 1866. Even fewer Americans remember what happened in Atlanta on Confederate Memorial Day in 1913. Well, now I'm telling you what happened. My mother sang a song, but she only had part of the verses. But this is a fabulous story. When a young woman's murder led to the creation of the Anti-Defamation League and reinvigorated its nemesis, the Ku Klux Klan. The Anti-Defamation League, which today is one of America's most recognized and respected human relations organizations, combats anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred worldwide, and receives funding from the Birmingham Jewish Federation annual campaign. Well, I'm going to tell you, the ADL is a communist hate group. Has been very successful in turning America away from the God they used to serve into a nation that serves other gods, knowingly or unknowingly. They have added now the Southern Poverty Law Center. When they write about you, they will go to either one of the two groups and ask about you. And whatever they say, they seem to believe. As a result, America is being what? Terrible floods in Colorado? Fires out west. How about the boardwalk in New Jersey? It's burnt to the ground. America is being cursed instead of being blessed. Here are a few of the accomplishments of the ADL as listed on their official website. It stopped to eradicate the negative images of Jews in print and their stereotyping on stage and in the movies. When it took them to 1920, the practice had virtually stopped. Second, soldiers targeted as being slackers and war profiteers, the United States Army manual, Jews. The manual was promptly ordered recalled by the Commander-in-Chief, President Woodrow Wilson. Three, during the Russian Revolution, cartoonists portrayed the Bolshevik as a bearded fellow with a Jewish countenance. That means what, a big nose? Hiding a bomb behind his back. This was traced to the Associated Press and was stopped. Fourth, fought a successful battle against the KKK. In 1923, the KKK Imperial Wizard condemned Jews as, quote, an unblendable element, alien and unsatiable money mad, unquote. The ADL called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion a forgery. They attacked Henry Ford and his Dearborn Independent newspaper. Fifth thing they did, they circulated pamphlets against the Dearborn Independent. President Wilson and other former presidents denounced Ford's anti-Semitism. Well, he wasn't anti-Semitic. He was anti-Jewish, anti-Zionist. Sixth, the ADL established facts to influence public opinion against job discrimination and quotas in higher education and sought legal remedies. Seventh, they attacked Charles E. Coughlin, the progenitor of hate, radio, and leader of pro-fascist Christian Front. The ADL produced a monograph which analyzed Coughlin's propaganda line and contained a thorough refutation of his anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish Zionist charges. Anybody remember Charles E. Coughlin? What a good man he was. And he was Catholic. Eight, in the 1940s, the ADL fought against bigots and fascist groups on American shores. The ninth, post-war tensions pointed to the need for an enactment of civil rights laws. It began its effort to change immigration laws that had prevented the rescue of many European Jews. Who did this? ADL says they did it. Tenth, played a major role in McCollum versus Board of Education, arguing that the government remains distinct from religion. Boy, that's a joke. 11th, fought against the Georgia KKK by infiltrating the Klan, causing widespread damage. 12th, fought against Senator Joseph McCarthy. I happened to meet Mr. McCarthy's private secretary. Randa met her too. Her name was Larry Lent. She was a CIA believer. When I saw her, I said, you need to write a book about your life with Joseph McCarthy. She did. I've got it in my library. She wrote a book about the times that Joe accused many of the elite in American society as being communist. She told me that he was correct and he was slandered. And he's still being slandered. It's like he is a terrible person. If you say you believe Joseph McCarthy, you're considered an outcast. He was correct. The ADL agreed with President Eisenhower when he spoke at the 40th anniversary dinner of the League as a platform to make his first public condemnation of McCarthyism and the character assassinations common during the period in the years that ensued. The ADL embarked on one of its earliest campaigns to thwart right-wing extremism. That's what I am, a right-wing extremist, by fighting the terrifying plague of McCarthyism. 13th reason, I had a school teacher in the 8th grade who said this was one of the most important Supreme Court cases that ever came to pass. Her name was Jenny Fine. Remember Jenny Fine? She was Jewish, by the way. Fought the case of Brown versus Board of Education. which ended what? The separate but equal school systems. Now we've got integrated school system. 14, in the 1960s, the ADL marched to the forefront of the fight for freedom, advocating for the individual's right to be judged by virtue of his character and not by immutable characteristics, that'd be skin color. Civil Rights Acts of 1964 and 68 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 were major accomplishments of the ADL. 15th, they fought against the John Birch Society and the anti-Catholic sentiment for President John F. Kennedy's campaign. 16, they fought for integration in the United States. They're fighting for integration in all the Israel nations, but wholeheartedly supported Israel, which is exclusively apartheid. They're hypocrites. They're the biggest apartheid nation in the world. They want everyone else to be mixed. In fact, you face the penalty of death or serious jail time if you try to convert a Jew to Christianity in the homeland of Israel. Jesus called the fathers of these people hypocrites, and that is exactly what they are doing. They want us to embrace diversity, which causes us to commit suicide, while they cling to exclusiveness. 17th reason the ADL did. And on it goes. Now they're in favor of homosexuality being nothing more than a lifestyle way of living, not an abomination to our God. They are in favor of same-sex marriages, abortion, birth control pills, on and on and on. They yell anti-Semitism. And how many times you have to say it? Over 90% of Jews are not Semites. Muslims are Semites. We're Semites. They're not Semites. They have a list of hate groups in America, and their name is missing from their own list, for they're one of the major hate groups. They are just like our Savior said they would be, liars and hypocrites. There have been several movies and books written about the Fagan murder. One Jewish author, Harry Golden, in his book, A Little Girl Is Dead, wrote that Mary Fagan was not a virgin. She was a very loose woman, which is nothing but an outright lie. My conclusion. My mother sang a song about Mary Fagan, a young girl who was murdered in an Atlanta pencil factory. Back in those days, they just had newspapers, magazines. They didn't have TV, radio. They wrote songs about what happened, and the songs were passed along. It's a shame my mother didn't get the meaning of the song. She was murdered by her Jewish supervisor, the president of the B'nai B'rith, who had raped and sexually harassed girls and boys before. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. Leo Frank was represented by the law firm Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips. The Slayton was Governor John M. Slayton, governor of Georgia. The departing governor of Georgia decided to what? He commuted the death sentence of his own client at the 11th hour to life in prison. Right before the end of his term of governor. What? It was an act of political suicide, but it didn't matter, as Slayton was leaving office anyway, and he was likely rewarded handsomely behind the scenes in other ways. Slayton left Georgia, went on a tour of the United States with a briefcase full of greenbacks. This was after numerous appeals were made by the Leo Frank defense team to Georgia Supreme Court, Georgia Superior Court, U.S. Federal District Court, and the United States Supreme Court. All appeals were denied after careful review with lengthy discussions written and rendered. In April of 1915, Leo Frank had exhausted all of his court appeals. So he went back to his lawyer, Luther Rosser, asking him to request a commutation from his law partner, Governor Slatton. After the governor, part of his own law team, had commuted his sentence, the population was in an outrage. An elite group of citizens from Mary's hometown took the law into their own hands. And I have to say, it's probably the last time it's ever happened. Now they no longer say anything about the Jews because of their fear of them, just like it was in Jesus' day. Leo Frank was a bisexual pedophile and a suspected drug addict who managed a pencil factory in Atlanta in 1913. One day, he demanded sex from a 12-year-old employee named Mary Fagan. She refused, so he brutally raped and murdered her. Frank and a handyman dragged the body to a basement where they were going to burn it in the factory furnace the next day. That night, a watchman finds the body, calls the police. Franks is arrested, found guilty, and sentenced to hang. The governor commutes the sentence, and Marietta's finest families broke into jail and lynched him. This incident led to the creation of the ADL in 1913. Today, the Jewish community hails Leo Franks as an innocent martyr, a victim of anti-Semitism. Isn't that what former Congressman Jim Traficant says? What did he say? The United States government is controlled by a Jewish gang of thieves, robbers, and murderers. They have given to America in recent days 9/11, the murder of Osama bin Laden, the 30 elite SEAL troops who were killed in Afghanistan in a crashed helicopter, 30 of them, one time. Oklahoma City bombing. Waco slaughter. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. The Aurora movie theater shooting. Sandy Hook elementary school murders. Boston Marathon bombing. And now we have the Syrian government accused of gas attacks on its own citizens. On and on it goes. They're nothing but giant hoaxes. This is the reason that Jesus Christ, our Savior, did not go where they were living until the time was right for his death. Now I've got a little history sign. Mary Fagan. To prove to you this is a true story. Although it does say she was 13 in this. She was 12 years old when she was murdered, the court case when she was 13. It says, celebrated in song as Little Mary Fagan. Well, that's the song my mother sang a fourth of the verses. After her murder, age 13, on August 26, 1913, in Atlanta. The trial and conviction of Leo Frank were controversial, as was the commutation of his death sentence 4 days before Confederate veterans marked her grave on June 23, 1915. He was abducted from prison and lynched August 17, 1915. In 1986, he was issued a pardon. There was a guy at the pencil factory. He was real old by that time. He said, well, I didn't see him do anything, so they issued a pardon because he was abducted and lynched. All I can say, blessed be the Lord God of Israel. Amen.